As a quick disclaimer, we just want to express the view that the Hoopercast does not think that bigotry is funny, nor is it something to be laughed about or laughed at.
I'll just put that at the beginning of the episode. People will be like, what? What? What are they going to talk about?
Stick around and see.
Just you wait. Hello, Dustin.
What's up, man?
We won't make any allegations about Bob Dylan this week.
Not this week.
Listen to last week's if you want that. Yep. Okay. Instead, I'd like to talk about Jennifer Lawrence.
Okay.
The poll. When you think of Bob Dylan, who's the opposite of Bob Dylan? An old grumbly pile of bones. Who's
it's
the opposite?
A young, energetic person.
A
named
young
Dill Bobbin.
Dill Bobbin.
That sounds like a Tolkien character.
Jennifer Lobbin. All right, I wanted to talk about Jennifer Lawrence for a bit here. I recently watched No Hard Feelings.
Stop, Gary.
Court order for asset seizure.
So they're taking my car?
You went radio silent on me.
Is that what this is about? Just last night, I thought I missed that fucker.
Is that true? Buongiorno.
That's my cousin. Gary, I swear to God, he's my cousin. Mm. He's my second cousin.
There's something seriously wrong with you.
I'm an Uber driver and I don't have a car. I'm gonna lose my house. You think I chose this? Look at this. Need a car, date our son this summer, and bring him out of his shell before college. In exchange, we'll give you a Buick Regal. Date is in quotes. It's gotta be a joke, right?
No, have you seen these helicopter parents? I'm surprised they're not gonna fuck them themselves.
We've just been so worried about our son.
He's going to Princeton in the fall.
Well, I've heard of it. You know, we tried everything to bring him out of his shell.
He doesn't come out of his room, he doesn't talk to girls, he doesn't drink.
So when you say date him, do you mean date him or date him? Yes.
Date him. Date him hard.
Okay. I'll date his brains out. He volunteers at the animal shelter. Hi. Mind if I touch your wiener?
What?
Your dog. How about I give you a ride home?
This isn't the way to my house.
It's a shortcut. You're my hostage. What you got down there? Something for me? Why?
You tried kidnapping me!
You're 19. Grow up! This kid is unfuckable.
Have a drink together.
He'll have a Long Island iced tea.
This is the worst iced tea I've ever had.
Okay, one thing about me, I'm the baddest alive.
Dance parties.
Don't know what to do. I just know my mom would have wanted me to save the house.
He's probably just nervous. Why don't you loosen him up?
We can go skinny dipping.
What about sharks?
Men here.
Jellyfish?
Not this season.
It's really the lack of lifeguards.
Let's get the fuck in here right now.
Okay.
I'm just a bit of a romantic.
He's actually really sweet. The best part about getting older is not giving a fuck what people think.
I'm an adult now. I can make my own decisions.
That's good.
You want to savor it. Savor it.
Come on, you're getting out of here. You don't belong here.
Don't Let's touch me.
Get away from her.
Stay.
Oh, fuck.
We should go.
Maddie, you can't outrun the cops.
I can't lose my license.
So No Hard Feelings came out in 2023. And it is co-written and directed by Gene Stupnitsky. His name sounded familiar to me, and I was like, what else has this
the
person
Office.
Made? Huh?
He was a director on The Office, wasn't he?
He wrote, he was a writer for 15 episodes, and then, but you're right though, yes, that's where I would have heard his name from. Yeah. And then it said he directed The Lover. He was an uncredited director for that episode. Mm. And then Michael Scott Paper Company. He directed that episode.
Okay.
So yes, but that's right. And he directed Good Boys, that movie, that R-rated comedy with Jacob Tremblay.
Oh, yeah.
He wrote Bad Teacher with Cameron Diaz, and he wrote Year One with Jack Black and Michael Cera.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, No Hard Feelings is a film starring Jennifer Lawrence. She's also a producer on this, which is another reason I wanted to check it out. Because I was like, that's always a good sign to me. Like, the more actors start producing their own stuff, especially women, the more I'm like, oh, cool. This is worth checking out, because
yeah,
they're not just a gun for hire. And, you know, and I like Jennifer Lawrence. I think over the years on this show, I have said a number of things. My opinion of her has evolved from kind of not liking her at all, but acknowledging she's a talented actor to thinking, you know, I feel like she's not fun to be around, but she seems fun to be around.
Sure.
I don't know what my deal was, what her deal was. But anyway, today in 2024, I like Jennifer Lawrence a lot. I wish, similar to how I talk about Taylor Swift, like Jennifer Lawrence seems like a real person to me. She seems very unserious about herself and kind of like she doesn't need the industry, which in my mind gives her power. Sure. So the Emmys happened, or the Golden Globe, one of them. And so her and Emma Stone are friends. And so Emma Stone and her are both like nominated for comedy or musical, I think. And then they're going through, you know, Emma Stone or whatever, and she's clapping. And then they go to, you know, Jennifer Lawrence, and Jennifer Lawrence looks at the camera and she mouths the phrase, "If I don't win, I'm leaving." And then Emma Stone wins and she gets up and like cheers and stuff. Like she was, you know, genuinely happy. You know, that's someone who wasn't expecting or caring if she won an award for this movie. You know, she just
sure.
And that's cool. That kind of stuff is you know, like she doesn't need us. And to me, that's like, now I need you. So that's the appeal of Jennifer Lawrence for me. So this movie, in this movie, she is a 32-year-old Uber driver in Montauk, New York. And she needs money because of plot, and she needs it quick. And so these kind of rich people who are summering in Montauk, like lots of people do, have put out a Craigslist posting asking for someone to quote unquote date their 19-year-old son before he goes to college, because he's they think he's very sheltered, and they're like, he needs the girlfriend experience, and he needs some, you know, basically he needs some sex. He needs some that, but also like, we don't want to send our kid off to college with like he has interest and stuff, but he is just totally uninterested or seemingly uninterested in dating or seeking companionship or relationships or even friendships. And so they're like, yeah, it's weird. You know, like, so she's like, okay, like I'll do it. And it's kind of like fudges her age a little bit and goes like, you know, but the film automatically like, so this film came under fire for like people going like, that's predatory. And she was like, look, he's the character's 19. And we're also not really saying that her character is doing the best, most altruistic thing. She's sheepishly, you know, using her body to make money. And it proves to be difficult because the dude is not picking up on like Jennifer Lawrence in a nice dress, in a tight dress, like just blatantly hitting on him.
Yeah.
He's like, oh, okay. And this
is something that our society has forgotten, isn't it? Like context is that we're so quick to say like, oh, you shouldn't do this, so don't depict it. It's like, well, what if we're depicting somebody who's kind of despicable or who's doing the wrong thing?
Who learned,
does that not warrant depiction? You know, it's like I had a conversation with somebody at one point who was talking about like, I just couldn't get behind The Office because they said too many, Michael Scott does too many things that are racist or whatever.
Right.
And I'm like, yeah, but the show doesn't glorify that.
Right.
Like the show continues. Michael is the butt of the joke.
Yeah.
Like that's the whole point. And so like here, if you're saying, well, it's predatory. Well, but we never said that this is ideal.
Right. It's called a sex comedy, you guys. And it's something that the world has forgotten.
Just comedy in general.
Yes, for sure. And sex comedy especially is like, once we decided, I mean, and forget like, you know, religious, political, whatever, like Gen Z in general is both very sex positive and very uninterested in seeing sex depicted in movies.
Yeah.
They don't want it. And yeah. Movies in general, there's books and articles about this very subject. Like, why are movies so sexless now? And it's like, and because, and again, like these are also like, you know, completely non-religious, like Gen Z people who are just like, doesn't do anything for the plot. And it's like, yeah, but sometimes it does. And sometimes it's character. There's that too. Mm-hmm. Movies aren't just plot. But you know, I'm generally down for like, okay, yeah, we don't need to like show people's bodies. Like, well, you know, like it can be exploitative, but it's like, it has been in the past, but sets are better and a little bit more equal now. And stuff is done with a lot more care, whatever. I'm not mad about it, but it's just in this time where there's a movement against depicting sex in movies. I thought it was interesting that in 2023, you know, Jennifer Lawrence is starring and producing in one. Cause I was like, you know, this is a person who doesn't need, cause I was drawn to it. Cause this, I knew some stuff about it. I knew that Jennifer Lawrence was nude in this film, which is a first for her, I think. And, but I also knew that the context with which she was not like a salacious or sexual one. It was something comedic. Mm-hmm. I didn't know what it was, but I was like, that's kind of funny. It's kind of funny that an actress makes that kind of choice, like, especially in your 30s where you know, you can start to sort of maybe feel, and she's had a child and everything. So you can start to maybe feel like, maybe I'm past the point where I want to be on camera like that. You know, that's a very young person's type of game. And when you're younger in your career, as I understand it, I've never been through this myself, but typically women in their careers are, and actors in general, but with regard to this subject, are a lot more game for what they're doing on camera because they need work and they want to make a name for themselves. They want to be remembered. And it's later in life where you go, I don't need to do that anymore. I'm established and that's it. And that part of my career is over. Plus I'm older and I'm less secure about things, blah, blah, blah. So whatever. All that to say, I was interested because I was like, okay, Jennifer Lawrence doesn't need a movie that relies on her looks to make a name for herself or to stand out. She kind of just is that way already. Mm-hmm. And I also knew that she was uninterested in depicting a character in that kind of context in a way that would be ultimately gross, you know?
Sure.
So because of all those things, I was like, I'm going to check this out. And I enjoyed it. I think she has a really infectious energy, Jennifer Lawrence, that she brings to all her performances. And it's that piece of herself, I think. She has a real fun. I mean, anytime you've seen her in like interviews, like she's fun in movies and she has a really charismatic presence to her. But when you see her in interviews, you see like someone who's more of a goofball and you see someone who's funny. And I've always realized that like Jennifer Lawrence is funny. She's probably really funny. Yeah. Maybe she's obnoxious, but she's definitely funny and has that same thing that I have, I think, which is I really want to make people laugh in this conversation. I want to say something a little shocking because I want to surprise you with what I say or do. And so for me, I go, oh, that's cool. I identify with that. And I like, you know, that interests me. So it was cool to see a movie where she brought that piece of herself that I felt like was very authentic to this character who is funny, awkward, doesn't quite have her life together. Not stupid though. And where the movie is expressly a comedy. I thought that it was fun to see her in this context. I don't have much more to say about the movie. Like, you know, whatever, people can see the movie. It was on Netflix at the time I saw it. I thought that it was, I never saw it in theaters, but, I thought it was interesting that this kind of movie existed, And much like we talked about with Oppenheimer and other kinds of movies, where we end up saying something like, it's important to show Hollywood that we don't just want them to make garbage and stuff that's based on other things. Yeah. Like, this is an original screenplay. This isn't, you know, this isn't based on anything. It's just it's a movie developed, and made, and
yeah,
and it's a middle budget. When the budget for this was $45 million. When's the last time you heard of that budget? Yeah. It's crazy.
Right.
So point being, it's solid. It's a solid thing. It's not groundbreaking. It's not subverting the genre really, except for
sure.
You know, it's a woman trying to get laid, but not for validation for herself, for money. And she can't, because her mark, a man, is not sold on sleeping with her right away.
Sure.
And so it's inherently a different kind of dynamic in the film. And by the end of it, you know, you've got characters who've learned stuff and who have done stuff and who have grown. And so in that way, it's satisfying to watch as well. It's one of those movies where it's, we do some fun things with the premise. We try to keep stuff a little bit fresh. And again, this nude scene with Jennifer Lawrence is it's a fight scene, and and it's funny, and she's funny in it.
Yeah.
You know, I'll say no more, because I watched it twice, and not because she's naked, because I thought it was funny. Like, I missed stuff because I was laughing so hard. Yep. So anyway, that's no hard feelings. I wanted to juxtapose that, if I could, with the first big movie, or the first movie that she was in that got a lot of attention, and that was Winter's Bone.
Mm-hmm. Way down in Missouri, where I heard this melody, the old folks were humming, the banjos were strumming, so sweet and low.
Mike Satterfield, A1 Bonds.
What is it you want?
We hold the bond on Jessup Dolly. He didn't show for court.
That ain't no run.
Jessup signed over everything. If he doesn't show at trial, see, the way the deal works is y'all gonna lose his house here. Got some place to go?
I'll find him.
Girl, I've been looking.
I said I'll find him. You see, the law was out here hunting Jessup. You know where he's at? I wouldn't tell him nothing if I did. I really gotta run Dad down to get him to show.
You ought not do that.
Dad's your only brother.
I don't know where he's at, and I ain't gonna go around asking after him neither.
Who might you be?
I'm Ree. My dad's Jessup Dolly.
You ain't here for trouble, are you?
I got a real bad need to talk to him.
Falcon just calls his witnesses.
How long before we get kicked off our own property?
I reckon y'all got this place about another week.
The law found Jessup's car. Somebody set fire to it. He wasn't in it.
Do you know those people going around saying you best shut up? People you want to listen to.
Get out of the truck. Put your hands where I can see them.
Is this going to be our time?
There's stuff that you're going to have to get over being scared of.
Get off!
Don't hurt my sister!
Get in the house!
No!
He was warned, and you wouldn't listen.
Where did I watch Winter's Bone? Winter's Bone was on Max, I think, when I saw it. So Winter's Bone was a 2010 film co-written and directed by Deborah Granick. And this is the movie that got Jennifer Lawrence nominated for the Academy Award. Second youngest best actress nominee at the time. I bet you the youngest was probably Jodie Foster. Well, at the time, it was Kaysha Castle Hughes for Whale Rider, But later, 2 years later, it was Kevonjane Wallace for Beasts of the Southern Wild.
Mm.
It's crazy because like it was Keisha Castle Hughes for 13, being 13 years old, Jennifer Lawrence, 20 years old. So she's the second youngest, right? Yep. And then 2 years later, Kevonjane Wallace, 9 years old.
Yep.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so in the movie, Jennifer Lawrence is this girl. She's got a couple of siblings. Her mom is mentally ill. Dad is not around. And you find out soon that he's not around because he is on bail for making meth because we are in the Ozarks of Missouri. And in the Ozarks of Missouri, and you can say I'm making fun of Ozarks, but I'm from Lower Alabama, so I'm allowed to make fun of this subject. They're making meth. And and there's meth in them there hills. and her dad is part of that whole circle. And so they are pretty destitute. Oh, that's literally the word they use on Wikipedia, actually. Like she's teaching her younger siblings like how to hunt squirrels, and they are scrounging for food, and it's not going great, right? And so she learns basically that if her dad, her dad doesn't appear for his court date, so sheriff shows up, and bail bondsmen show up, and they're like, "Look, if he." If he doesn't show up for this, whatever, this other date, you're going to lose the house because he put the house up as part of his bond. And if that happens, then you got them, you know, they're going to, county will take the house and you guys are homeless. And she's like, okay, I'm going to find him. So she, the movie is her setting out to find her father so that she can save the house. And it's a really great performance by Jennifer Lawrence. I think she's great in everything. I haven't seen a performance of hers in this film or in the ensuing years of the past decade where I've been like, like I've always felt like Jennifer Lawrence brings it. Even in a movie like No Hard Feelings, where she's sort of playing herself in a way, or much more of just a relaxed version of herself. So in Winter's Bone, we've got a whole range of stuff going on, and it's really remarkable for her to be carrying the film the way she does, especially when you're acting opposite someone like John Hawkes. And I mean, it's a Dale Dickey's in this. I ain't no skank. Speaking of meth, I say that because she's in Breaking Bad, not because she does meth. She's played a couple people who are associated with meth.
Yes.
Yeah. That must be weird to hear. Your agent goes, "You got a real meth look about you." But I guess when you're an actor, you go, "Does that mean I'll work?" And they go, "Oh,
does that give
yeah,
me money."
Yeah, like there's a lot of meth. Meth is huge right now. Like meth is where it's at narratively. Mm-hmm. Then if you're Dale Dickey, you go, "Great,
cool.
Put me in all the meth shows you want."
That's fine.
You have like a nice house in like whatever Glendale. Like this is the house that meth built.
That meth bill. She's like, "That's fine. I'll sit in the makeup chair." And they're like, "Oh, no need.
No
need. Just show up as you are.
Continue to go outside without sunscreen. And that's all we need from you."
She's like, "Do you need my measurements?" "Nope. Just bring your own wardrobe.
Yeah.
What you're wearing right now is fine.
Go borrow some clothes from Bob Dylan."
"Hey, man, I resemble that remark."
Go shop at Vagrants R Us. Anyway, so this movie, so it was good. I enjoyed it. I really love when a world and its characters feel lived in. And so the movie is really good at it's a really good script. It's you know, we're discovering, learning things along the way. We're withholding information. We don't know everything from the outset. She learns things about her dad as we go. We learn things about her dad. People try to throw her off the scent. There's people who don't want her to figure this out because it endangers other criminal enterprises. There's a lot of most of the people she goes to for help or information are in some way related to her. And so she's going to more and more distant kin in this area to learn stuff. And so there's pre-existing like bad blood and bad relationships. And it's one of those things where you just go, oh, cool. Like, I'm not being spoon-fed exposition about what your deal is. I have to subtly pick up on your performance and actual subtle writing to orient myself in your relationship with this character.
Yes.
And that's satisfying as an adult watching a movie. And so, yeah, you've seen this, but it's been a while, right?
I saw it in 2010 when it was released.
Wow.
I haven't seen it since, but I remember like the things that stuck out to me are, so Deborah Granik is a fantastic filmmaker, and I've seen this and I've seen Leave No Trace, and they're similar in that they're kind of like slower, more contemplative, quiet kind of films. Like you said, they don't spoon feed you everything. You need to be actively watching, and I find that interesting. The thing I remember most is the setting and the lived in feel of all of the actors and their performances. Like, I'm sure there's a lot of research done by them and by the production to get the setting correct. And this world that this is kind of its own little unique subculture. I think that it's very interesting to watch for that reason. But again, it just feels so lived in, and the actors all feel like they inhabit these real people. And so that's what stuck with me. And Leave No Trace was very similar. So Deborah Granik has a really good hold on people and what these like cultures and subcultures are, and what kind of what makes people tick, and not giving us, the audience members, everything about that, but allowing us to become a little bit part of the narrative by making our brains actively try to decipher these things. And I remember that Jennifer Lawrence was the standout. And like, when I saw it, I didn't know who she was. She obviously hadn't been Katniss yet, and she wasn't Mystique yet. So there's no preconceived notion as to who she might be. I watched this in 2010 because it was recommended to me in school by a professor. Who I think saw some similarities in something that I was writing, and nevertheless, encouraged me to watch this. And that's what I took away from it was, you know, how do we as writers create a world and act and characters who feel as if they are real and not just like one stereotypes or two, archetypes of, you know, just any other character that we've just like transplanted into this world. And instead let the world inform who they are. And it feels to me like Deborah Granik has a really great sense of that. And that's what stuck with me. So I also recommend this film. I have not seen it, like I said, since 2010. So it's been quite a long time. I would love to revisit this movie. But yeah, and I think maybe I will, but I remember really enjoying it.
Yeah. And it's always a toss up for me going, cause I'm watching movies that are 20 years old. So I expect a certain amount of like time and craft to not be caught up already. Sure. The weird thing about watching a movie 10 or 12 years old is you go, oh, like, am I ready for what cameras could do in 2010 or whatever? Like,
yeah,
there's always a part that goes like, this is feels modern, but it's not. Yeah. And whereas watching like Man on Fire, like I did recently, you go, okay, it's made 20 years ago. So like your brain kind of goes into a different mode.
Yeah.
But no, I'm glad I watched it. I've really gravitated towards any story that explores like the other side of the coin of Southern culture. Because a whole lot of people's idea of the South, you know, that isn't slave related is like bougie rich South. It's like, it's like gentrified South, you know?
Sure.
It's proper and artifice and polite society South. And I enjoy watching movies about the South or set in the South where it's like, we either explore that culture, that society's relationship with the an underclass element, or it's completely about the underclass. Like this is why I like Justified. What was I talking about recently where this is an element? Anyway, Winter's Bone is sort of, I mean, all these characters are dirt poor. And that is, you know, there's something about films set in the South that have this inherent quality to them that I can't describe. I don't know if it's just because of where we live or if that's like just part of Southern's, I mean, Deborah Granick is from like Massachusetts, I think, but who wrote the book? Daniel Woodrell. Who's that guy from? Missouri. Okay. So anyway, I think there's something inherently Southern about certain kinds of stories. It's very much linked to this area of the country where it's not in others. You know what I mean? Like you always hear about like the Southern writers, like you don't hear about like, oh, the great, you know, the great Northeastern storytellers. Like you just, for some reason we associate the Northeast with like academia and the South. When people are nice, the South gets a lot of credit for storytelling and for writing. And then I guess the West gets it for like whatever tech, like, you know, innovation and whatever else. But like, I don't know. Anyway, the point being like, I feel I always get to sort of engage with that spirit of this geography when I watch or read something that feels like it taps into that, you know?
I think it's interesting. The South is a weird hodgepodge of ideas, and we all have this image, I think, in our brains of like what the South is. And it's like somebody sitting on the front porch sipping lemonade and, you know, it's a Sunday afternoon and, you know, and it's like, I mean, I've never done that in my life, but I've lived in the South all my life, but that's still kind of the image in my brain. If you say like, you know, give me a Southern image. And it's like, I don't know, Chick-fil-A and football. I don't know. Like, I don't know what to, like my brain, you know, goes to these places.
Yeah.
But then if you, I think what's interesting is when you can take these ideas, which tend to be idyllic or simplified maybe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you take that and you break it apart and say, okay, but now instead of everybody being simple, they're ridiculously complex. And now instead of like this idyllic, we're sitting on the front porch sipping lemonade because we don't have a care in the world, we're dirt poor and we might lose the house.
Yeah.
You know, it's like you break it and you like put all of this angst that everyone feels back in and layer it back in the South. And suddenly it becomes like a dark gothic tale almost, or it becomes some sort of weird twisted version of the South.
What makes
that
it gothic?
I think is interesting.
It's always a word that gets used with Southern storytelling. What makes it gothic?
I think gothic, and without having it pulled up in front of me, like my mind always goes to gothic is a little more deranged. It's a little more violent or dark in tone. And
because I love that.
Yeah, it's great.
Yeah.
And like, so while we're here, Southern Gothic,
let's find out what
Google's
yeah.
Blends Gothic tropes with the American South setting. So let's say, well, what is then Gothic literature?
Right. Yeah.
So Gothic literature, style of writing that is characterized by elements of fear, horror, death, and gloom, as well as romantic elements such as nature, individuality, and very high emotion.
Yeah.
These emotions include fear and suspense.
Yeah.
So, like you hear a lot of this, like Gothic, what was it? Was it Flannery O'Connor that had once written that story, of like the neighbors smelled a smell from the house and you know, someone had a rotting corpse, and like, this is what, you know, I'm not up on my Southern literature, but sort of the earliest version of, taking the Southern tropes and then twisting them into something macabre. And like that to me is super interesting.
Yeah.
And we've almost fallen back into this weird thing, and, you know, I'm not going to like pin it on anybody, but for me, if you think about like what Reese Witherspoon has been doing her whole career, for the most part, it's like, well, these Southern kind of stories, but they're, you know, these lighthearted comedy, and everybody's kind of in a nice-ish house and, you know, dressed very nice, and we're watching football and we're having a turkey, and, you know, it's like, you know, fried chicken on Sundays or whatever. It's like, these are elements, I think, that have become stereotypical of the South, but they don't actually represent a lot of people. So I think to me, what's most interesting is if you can take what is unique about the South and then make it as broad as you can.
Yeah.
Not in terms of like, you know, when you think of the word broad derogatorily, but instead you're taking it and saying like, what's common to humankind.
Yeah.
And let's put that into the American South setting. And then, you know, weave in a little bit of the macabre, and that's, now you're in Gothic territory, but then for this, for Winter's Bone, it's okay. Well, let's take, you know, these ideas, of like the struggle of life and put that into the American South. And to me, now we're doing something a little more interesting than just, you know, here's a Southern story. And what you're imagining is, you know, something about, you know, church on Sundays. And that's not quite, you know what I mean? Like that, yeah. That's not quite as interesting. So yeah, I, and it's weird because like, you were around me in college, and obviously a lot of what I wrote tended to have that Southern, like they were set in the South, and, you know, there's an element of write what you know, but yeah. At the same time, I was always interested in, you know, how can I more accurately depict my experience with the South, which, is limited, right? As just like a middle-class white dude, like it's a very narrow view, but at the same time, it's a view that I don't think is represented much because for whatever reason, when we watch Southern movies, it's like well-to-do people who talk very proper.
Yeah.
You know, how dare you, sir?
Yes.
And it's like, you know, the thing that I'm much more, like when I grew up, what was way, way more on my horizon was like people who are like salt of the earth, just like trying to get by, you know, and they cared a lot about family, and they cared a lot about, the things that they were passionate about, the things that they cared about. Mm-hmm. And when, you know, and it's the South. So a lot of times that seems to feel like all anyone cares about is like trucks and football and whatever, but there's a lot more to it than that. And there's a lot of, smart people with varying interests in the South.
Yeah.
So my thought was always like, how can I showcase those people? And so, you know, I relate to films like Winter's Bone, where, you know, let's just show some people. And obviously, like, I've never done meth, so I don't relate on that level, but I certainly understand people who have struggled.
Yeah.
And that's way more interesting than the struggle being like, well, we seem to have lost one of our cornfields last night.
Right.
You know, and it's like, okay.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah.
What a struggle, you know, or, you know, or whatever the case may be. You know, I don't know. A lot of times Southern comedies are like, well, my daughter started dating a black fella. And it's like, okay, how is this a conflict? I don't understand.
What do you mean? How's it not a conflict?
How does that not compute with you, sir?
Where do you say you from again?
I'm from Georgia. Well, where in Georgia do you?
You must come from some Georgia I've never heard of, sir. I don't know.
Well, in my Georgia, this is quite an obscure occurrence. I do declare.
Well, I do declare that you need to broaden your horizons, sir.
Oh, I need to broaden my horizons. You're upset by this interracial thing going on.
Now, I never said that. Well, I just strongly implied it.
I just implied it very strongly, but
I implied it very well not looking him in the eye for the whole course of our meal.
I expressed my displeasure surreptitiously. I don't think so, man. I think everyone, it's pretty clear.
I told him very plainly that I thought very highly of Samuel L. Jackson.
I repeatedly explained that my favorite actor was James Earl Jones. And he said, "Who's that?" And I said,
and I told him I would have voted for Barack if it hadn't have been for the guy running against him. If you had handed me a ballot, sir, and Barack was the only choice, I'd have surely voted for Barack.
Of course. I would have voted for him and not torn up the ticket and thrown it in the mud. I'm not a monster. I make sensical decisions when I have no other choice.
I'm not a monster. I'm a beast. There's a difference.
I'm a cretin. Yeah.
I'm what they call a bigot.
It's literally
in fact,
my.
That's what it says on my birth certificate.
It's literally my middle name,
Marshall James Edward Bigot the Third, sir. I come from a long line of bigots. My father was a bigot,
and his father before him was a bigot. It says Francis Bigot the Third, but I am far from the third bigot in my family. I do declare. I'm just the third bigot in a row named Francis.
When we rented out the country club and put up our large banner that said Bigot Family Welcome, well, we had a lot of interesting folks show up.
My great-grandfather was Sinclair Bigot. Now, Sinclair Bigot was a hard man.
And his wardrobe was full of white, if you get my drift. I get it, Mr. Bigot. Please, that's cool. Don't go any further.
May I please leave?
First, I want you to take one of these buttons that says "Vote for Bigot."
Are you running for office, sir?
No, but people seem to like them around here, and I sell many of them.
His daughter stands up. Daddy, I don't want to be a bigot anymore. I'm going to marry him.
Listen,
and
Shirley,
I'm no longer going to be a
you
bigot.
You're a bigot, and it's about time you accepted it.
That bigot blood runs through your veins.
Once a bigot, always a bigot.
Always a bigot.
That's
what it says on this here plaque. What's the big? It's in gold, 24 karat gold.
Francis the First is like 120, still in a wheelchair, and he's like, yeah, yeah.
played by Bob Dylan.
He's just lighting. He's lighting his CO2 tank like a bong and just smoking tobacco.
That's better. No great, 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 great granddaughter of mine is going to not be a bigot.
If you must hyphenate your name so that you are Shirley Bigot Jones.
I won't do it, Father.
You'll be a bigot. And your children will be bigots.
I will cut you off from the bigot money.
And your pets will be bigots. And you, well, as I said before, will be a bigot. I'm just saying it again because I took a breath and I had to use it or I shall perish.
The daughter has an older brother. His name is Stanley Bigot.
And I believe grandfather has passed away. There's one more bigot in heaven. You know, one day I'm going to make a compilation that's only these silly bits. Oh, man. And it might be the most enjoyable thing I'll ever make in my life.
is our improv silliness. Oh, man.
It'll be a fun little lower third that goes, the bigot family.
That's a capital B I G O T.
That's some good shit. The
big. What I call James Edward Bigot, that's his name, the third.
I think I relabeled him Francis Bigot.
That's fine.
I couldn't remember. I didn't want to break the flow.
Yeah, they're all whatever.
They're all the same.
They're all a bunch of bigots.
Those bigot boys are the spitting image of their father. Well, I saw him from down the street. And I said, now, if that isn't a bigot, if that isn't one of those bigot sons.
The daughter's boyfriend is like, all you bigots look the same to me.
I was really hoping that when I got together with you, like it wouldn't. This is exactly what I feared this interaction would be with your family.
I just want to see. He makes a very big, impassioned plea. He's like, now, I just have to say, I love your daughter very much. And it doesn't bother me that she's a bigot. In fact, I hope that one day she won't be anymore. But I came here as a gesture of goodwill to you to ask your permission to marry your daughter.
You have my permission to get off my bigot family plot. You hooligan. You naysayer. Witch.
You tell him, Daddy. That's the older brother, Stanley. Now you hush up, Stanley. There's a reason you don't have my name. You're not James Edward the Fourth.
I have to say, sir, even if this was a different situation, I would still suspect you of being a witch. That's a separate issue.
Daddy, I just want to say I agree with everything you're saying. Shut up, Stanley.
Be quiet. You're such a kiss ass.
Stop your brown nosing. Now, I'm going to go to your little brother. He's like 2 years old. He's in the high chair. Your little brother. Now, he is James Edward Bigot material. He is James Edward Bigot the Fourth. And it's just the baby in the high chair. And he's like, I hate people who aren't like myself.
I shall take great-grandfather's place. Give me more cigarettes.
But why, Daddy? I've done everything you've ever asked. No, no, you haven't. I caught you watching that Will Smith movie that one time. It was just once. It was a moment of weakness, Father.
You've yet to die. You've not done everything I asked.
Why do you hate me, Father?
Why? Because it's my nature to hate. And I've surrounded myself only with people like myself who hate the same things as me. And it makes me sad because I have nothing to hate or with which to intellectually stimulate me. And so I project onto you all the things that I wish I could be if I only had the chance to do them over again. But I cannot. And therefore I hate you. I hate you so much. And I wish you to be destroyed so that I may rest.
His wife puts her arm on his hand, like, James, just shut up, woman. Daddy, you never let mother talk. That's because she's a woman.
She's a woman.
She's only a bigot because she married me. She's not a real bigot to her core, and therefore I do not trust her. I suspect her motives.
She's after the bigot money.
The bigot money. The bigot family fortune. The BFF.
The BFF. BFF. You'll never guess the passcode to the vault.
Let me guess. Is it bigot?
We need to change the passcode.
Okay, I'm going to change it really quick. Is it 3 Ks in a row? Oh! Foiled again. Change it to the birthday of the whitest person who's ever lived. And that person is... That's the setup. Go Hooper.
Jennifer Lawrence.
Jennifer Lawrence. I think you could probably cut that a long time ago.
Well, if time and experience have taught me anything, I will be editing this in the background while I do my finances. And I will hear you say that line and I'll go, oh shit, I wasn't paying attention. And then I won't do anything about it.
That's fine.
All right, hold up. My son must have talked to me. Just okay. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.